From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, the Texas ban on same-sex marriage is ruled unconstitutional. What happens now? New polling shows that Texans are changing their views on key political issues and saving the sea turtles of the Texas coast. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. On Wednesday, U.S. District Judge Orlando Garcia of San Antonio granted a motion for a preliminary injunction preventing the state of Texas from further enforcement of restrictions in the Texas Family Code and the Texas Constitution that have prevented same-sex couples from marrying in Texas. Judge Garcia ruled that the Texas ban on same-sex marriage violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment in the U.S. Constitution. Here's a key passage of the Garcia ruling. Today's court decision is not made in defiance of the great people of Texas or the Texas legislature, but in compliance with the U.S. Constitution and Supreme Court precedent. Without a rational relation to a legitimate governmental purpose, state-imposed inequality can find no refuge in our U.S. Constitution. Texas social conservatives and Republican leaders were critical of the ruling. Governor Rick Perry responded with this statement. Texans spoke loud and clear by overwhelmingly voting to define marriage as a union between a man and a woman in our Constitution, and it is not the role of the federal government to overturn the will of our citizens. The 10th Amendment guarantees Texas voters the freedom to make these decisions, and this is yet another attempt to achieve via the courts what couldn't be achieved at the ballot box. We will continue to fight for the rights of Texans to self-determine the laws of our state. Texas Attorney General and Republican candidate for Governor Greg Abbott, while on the campaign trail in San Antonio, had this to say just after the ruling was released.
Well, you know, this is an issue where there are good people on both sides of the issue. And as the court pointed out today, today's ruling is just one step along the pathway toward resolving this. The court recognized the issue will be decided by a higher court. And so we will just continue the effort of defending the Texas Constitution. And if the Supreme Court or the lower courts apply well-established Supreme Court principle, the Texas Constitution will be upheld.
So how are Texas same-sex marriage advocates reacting to the ruling? We checked in with Chuck Smith, president of Equality Texas.
Very pleased and supportive that Judge Garcia chose to uphold the United States Constitution and declare the restrictions in Texas not only unconstitutional, but also unenforceable.
So was this the ruling that you were hoping for, more than you hoped for, or were there any disappointments at all?
This is the ruling that we were hoping for. The immediate stay was not a surprise in the preliminary arguments for the injunction. The judge acknowledged that this is an issue that, you know, that he's not ultimately going to be the decision maker. This is an issue that ultimately is going to be decided by the U.S. Supreme Court. So the granting of the stay was not unexpected.
So explain what that means, the granting of the stay.
I mean, as a matter of law, the judge has granted the injunction, ruled the statutory and constitutional provisions as being unconstitutional, but recognizes that the state is going to appeal this case. And that there are other similar cases to this pending in the federal judicial system. And so he didn't want to if he had not ordered a stay, then probably hundreds, if not thousands, of couples in Texas would have proceeded to get married. But then he, you know, recognizing that this is an issue that ultimately is going to be resolved by the U.S. Supreme Court, and didn't want to put any of those couples in a state of legal limbo waiting for some ultimate resolution.
Yeah, so let's talk about the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans, which is the next stop for this case from Texas. The court there is notoriously socially conservative. What's your anticipation there?
We're just going to have to wait and see what happens there. Many people would agree that this court is probably less likely than some of the other circuits to rule favorably on this issue. Yet at the same time, if the Fifth Circuit were to overturn Judge Garcia, then that's likely to create a conflicting status with similar cases that are likely to happen either in the Denver District or in Virginia. And that's exactly the thing that the Supreme Court would be looking for as a reason that it would need to take one of these cases in order to resolve that conflict.
So losing at the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals is just another step along the process, not something to fret about.
I think that's exactly true. Even if the Fifth Circuit were to overrule Judge Garcia, the plaintiffs and the law firm representing them, have said that they are committed to pursuing this all the way to the Supreme Court if that's possible.
And any idea when the Supreme Court could get a hold of this? Because that's when we're waiting for the final word.
I think many people prognosticate. It could be as soon as their 2015 session. But probably sometime between 2015 and 2017.
And for couples that are waiting in the interim, what do they do?
They're going to have to continue to wait if they want to marry in Texas, or they can go to one of the other states that currently allow lesbian and gay couples to get married. But then they'd have to come back to Texas, and their marriage would not be recognized.
But it would be recognized on a federal level.
The state of Texas would not recognize it. But yes, in terms of the Internal Revenue Service and at this point, virtually all federal agencies would acknowledge their marriage.
Chuck Smith is the president of Equality Texas, reacting to a federal judge's ruling that the Texas ban on same-sex marriage violates the U.S. Constitution. Texas banned same-sex marriage in 1997 when the state legislature added the line, a license may not be issued for the marriage of persons of the same sex, to the state family code. Then Texas banned same-sex marriage again in 2003 when the legislature passed a ban on civil unions and officially declared civil unions and same-sex marriages performed in other states to be void in Texas. Then in 2005, Texas triple banned same-sex marriage with a constitutional amendment that passed with 76% of the vote. Today, it looks like support for same-sex marriage in Texas has changed, but it still lags behind the approval level nationwide. According to polling data released in November 2013 from Public Policy Polling, 34% of voters in the state support same-sex marriage and 57% are opposed. But attitudes about different issues are changing rapidly in Texas. That's what a new poll from the University of Texas and the Texas Tribune is finding out. Jim Henson is the director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin and co-director of the poll.
Yeah, one of the interesting things we saw in terms of our, what we think of as our mood of the state questions is, it was kind of twofold. One, and this is a result that's been fairly consistent, is that Texans are much more optimistic about the future of Texas than they are in the state of things here than they are about the state of the nation, if you will. So in our right track, wrong track question, Texans were much more positive about Texas being on the right track than they were about the United States. But one of the things that we've seen in this that's, I think, interesting and easy to lose is that if you take out our last poll, which was in October right after the shutdown, when the government shut down, when people's attitudes just really kind of melted down, we've been on a steady but gradual trend of improvement in both of those assessments. Nonetheless, Texans are much more optimistic about Texas and the country. 45% thought the state was on the right track, only 35% on the wrong track. The corresponding question for the nation, only 25% thought the country was going in the right direction, 63% saying wrong track.
That's a huge number. That's not good.
It's not good, although, if you go back to where it peaked, right at the height kind of the recession, it peaked at about 75% wrong track. I think the other thing to notice about those numbers is that they're very colored by bipartisanship. So if you break those down, Republicans are overwhelmingly negative about the direction of the country, much more negative than Democrats. Conversely, Republicans much more positive about the direction of the state, with Democrats much more negative about the direction of the state. And that's very much a partisan judgment. you know, one of those areas where we see party polarization, not only in Washington, but in the electorate, too.
The electorate is electing right now. We're in our primary races, and you did do some polling to see where voters are headed. And so you're finding out, at least in the lieutenant governor's race, we're getting an idea where that might turn out.
Yeah, I mean, the lieutenant governor's race has been the most competitive race in the primary season up to this point, since at the gubernatorial level, neither General Abbott nor Senator Davis have much competition. But in the lieutenant governor's race, very hotly contested. Among likely voters, we found the lieutenant governor, David Dewhurst, with 37. Senator Dan Patrick, who is emerging as something of the Tea Party candidate, with 31. And then a little further down, Todd Staples with 17, Jerry Patterson with 15%.
So just looking at your polling, it's not the election yet, so it still could change, but we do look like we probably will get an exciting runoff, very similar to what we had with David Dewhurst and Ted Cruz, an establishment candidate with a Tea Party challenger.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think that's a fair way to look at it, although I'd put a little bit of an asterisk on that, in that to the extent that none of us step in the same stream twice, I think you could say that of Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst. He's been much more attentive to tending to the conservative grassroots in the Republican Party. He's running a bit more strongly among Tea Party. He's not the leader among Tea Party Republicans, but he's getting a decent share, and he's actually, you know, doing better among people with the most restrictive abortion attitudes in the Republican Party than Senator Patrick, which is something that the Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst worked really hard to do during the session, and that was make sure that he proved his bona fides with the pro-life constituency among the Republican primary electorate.
Other polling you did looked at the attitudes about immigration reform, which has been a big topic in the lieutenant governor's race. And are you seeing any shifting in the way people feel about that?
Well, it's interesting. We've seen a short-term shift. And to be honest with you, I'm not sure it's going to be permanent. It's something we're going to watch. But for the first time since we've been asking this question on comprehensive immigration reform, which basically asks people if they would favor a comprehensive immigration reform at the federal level that contained a path to citizenship, we found 51%, not much of a majority, but a bare one, in favor, and 44 oppose. And that shows some movement. That's a 6-point increase in the positive response compared to our October poll. It's still very polarized. 69% of Democrats support comprehensive immigration reform, only 36 of Republicans. But the Republican support has gone up 9 points since October.
And that is an interesting swing. And why do you think this is not going to be sustainable, or you suspect this is a temporary swing?
Well, I suspect it because it's counter to the trend that we've seen. Restrictive attitudes on immigration and opposition to comprehensive immigration reform, when it's framed that way, has been a hallmark of public opinion among Republicans. It's one of the reasons that you're seeing the kind of rhetoric that you are seeing in the competitive primaries in Texas right now. But on the other hand, there has been a pretty sustained conversation going on, particularly among Republican leaders and if you will, Republicans kind of in charge of thinking about the long term, who are trying to moderate the party's profile. Up to this point, they've not had a lot of success, and I think that's been evident in the rhetoric we're seeing in many parts of the Republican primary right now. But this does make me wonder if that discussion is beginning to have some effect, if only around the edges.
Another national discussion that could be having an impact on Texas attitudes about marijuana, and you polled on that.
You know, we asked people if they wanted to, you know, continue to have marijuana be illegal in any amounts, or if they would legalize it for medical use, legalize small amounts for personal use, or legalize any amount for personal use. And we found that really only 23% of Texans chose the completely illegal option. And if you kind of play with this and work the different options, 49% were in favor of either legalization of either small amounts or any amount for personal purposes. And, roughly 75% are willing to legalize it in one way or the other. And I think in this sense, this is one of those areas where, you know, you can be surprised by how dedicated Texans are to personal liberties in some areas.
Jim Henson is the director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin and the co-director of the UT Texas Tribune poll. Tuesday is primary day in Texas, and political watchers and pundits from across the nation will be watching the results and wondering about the workings of Lone Star politics. But is Texas where crazy gets elected? That's what Michael Tomansky writes in his column for the Daily Beast.
I start out by talking about Abbott and Nugent and how it appears that not only has that not hurt him in the polls, but if anything, it seems to be helping him a little bit in the polls. So that's one thing. Then there's the woman who seems to lead the Democratic primary, and I know Democratic primaries like, you know, who wants that prize sometimes in your state, but it's rather odd that she's a LaRouche figure and promises to try to impeach Obama and repeal Obamacare, and she's the leading Democrat. That seems a little odd to those of us from elsewhere.
That's Keisha Rogers.
But, you know, what's oddest to me, David, is a more serious thing, and this is something I've written a lot about over the past few months, not only in the context of Texas, but many other states, and that's the refusal to participate in the Affordable Health Care Act. And I know, I don't have to be told, people hate Obama, people hate Obamacare, people hate Washington, people hate the government, but we're talking about $9.2 billion for free that Texas, a state with the highest percentage of uninsured people within its borders of any of the 50 states, $9.2 billion that Texas could be getting for free. And of course Perry doesn't want it. Of course Abbott doesn't want it. I understand that. What I don't fully understand is why Democrats running for statewide office, who are long shots anyway, don't try to make a bigger deal out of this.
So if they were able to run on the expansion of Medicaid in Texas or being more robust with Obamacare here in Texas, setting up a Texas exchange, then that would be something that would excite the base and maybe give people something to vote for. Because they say Texas is not a Republican voting state. It's a non-voting state because our turnout is the worst in the nation.
Yeah. The turnout is small and is low. I know that. And meanwhile, you've got, you know, 38% of Latinos are uninsured, 22% of African Americans, 23% of women. I imagine a lot of those people, in addition to not being insured, probably aren't regular voters, too. Maybe you could make them voters by giving them something to be excited about voting for. Look, I'm not saying she'd win. I, you know, admire what Wendy Davis did with that filibuster as much as a lot of people of my political persuasion around the country. I don't want to knock her. I know that she's up against a tough, she's drawn a tough assignment, trying to win, the governorship of Texas as a Democrat. And if she wants to be risk averse, well, you know, maybe that's a little bit understandable, too. But why not give it a shot? You know, why not try to energize these people who don't always vote, as you say, and talk about this $9 billion, 250,000 jobs, other reports have found, that might come to Texas in the healthcare business if Texas took this money and set up its own exchange. I really do think, you know, maybe it's not possible in Texas, but certainly in some states, if Democrats really went to the mat on this issue of passing up this free money, I think they could get somewhere with it.
Michael Tomansky is a columnist for the Daily Beast, and he is the editor of the quarterly Democracy, a journal of ideas. In Texas, tasers are not permitted for use in county or state juvenile facilities. Even residential treatment centers in Texas, which house children with serious behavioral problems, including those that have been found delinquent by the courts, are prohibited from using tasers or pepper spray for disciplinary or emergency behavioral interventions. But tasers and pepper spray are allowed in Texas public schools to be used on the students. Now, a coalition of advocacy organizations are calling on Governor Rick Perry to issue a moratorium on tasers and pepper spray in public schools. Lauren Rose is the Juvenile Justice Policy Associate with the organization Texans Care for Children. How bad is it that students are getting tased and pepper sprayed?
In terms of how often it's happening, unfortunately, there's not really accountability and data collection around the use of force in schools. So we only know about the instances that are reported in the media, but we've seen instances of pepper spray and tasers reported throughout the state.
The TEA doesn't require any sort of tallying or reporting and collecting this data, so there's no way of knowing if this is a huge problem.
Correct. We've asked the legislature for multiple sessions in a row to begin data collection on these instances, but we have not had success at this point. So it's very unclear how often youth are subjected to this kind of force.
What do we do know?
We do know that there are instances with young students being injured, seriously injured, and receiving emotional trauma from instances of being pepper sprayed and tasers in schools, when what we're seeing is not necessarily with good reason behind that, and our schools and our students not feeling safe around the officers.
So it looks like we're seeing evidence, some anecdotal evidence of individual instances where these things have been recorded on YouTube of students, young students, being hit by tasers or pepper spray by who? Guards?
Police officers, either contracted by the school by the school district or police officers who are employees of the school district.
There's been some dramatic instances. One Texas student at Cedar Creek High School, he was in a coma for more than 50 days with traumatic brain injury after being tased.
As far as we have been able to tell, will suffer from those injuries for the rest of his life. In an instance where there is video showing that he was not acting aggressively and was actually backing away from an officer before he was tased.
So what does Rick Perry have to do with this? So how does Rick Perry get involved?
Well, so we've asked the Texas Commission on Law Enforcement and the Texas Education Agency both to create standards and a prohibition on using such force in students, and both have said they do not have the authority to do so. We previously have asked the legislature to create standards around these issues and have been unsuccessful. So now we're asking Governor Perry to stand up for Texas children and put a moratorium on the use of tasers and pepper spray until action can be taken to ensure that youth are kept safe in their schools.
What do you want people to do here?
I would say it's multifold. I think people should reach out to school districts and ask them to create policies to prohibit the use of pepper spray and tasers on students, and also encourage state leaders to do the same.
At the very least, we need better information about what's going on, right?
Absolutely, and if nothing else, improved data collection around the use of force and the day-to-day activities of school police. There's not data collection in a clearinghouse for school police activity in the state.
Lauren Rose is the Juvenile Justice Policy Associate with Texans Care for Children. They're part of a coalition calling on Governor Perry to issue a moratorium on the use of tasers and pepper spray in Texas public schools. The cold snap that hit Texas this week took a lot of folks by surprise, but probably no one was caught more off guard than the endangered green sea turtles on the Texas coast. Donna Shaver is chief of the Division of Sea Turtle Science and Recovery at Padre Island National Seashore with the U.S. National Park Service.
The winter has actually been tough on the green turtle. We've had over the winter from November 25th, 2013 through about 3 month time span into February, we had 1,175 green turtles that were found cold stunned in Texas. And 895 of those were found alive, and then the remainder were located dead. And
well, tell me what cold stunned is. I don't know that.
Sure. Cold stunned turtle is one that is found either floating or washed ashore, very lethargic or dead. And these are reptiles, so they can't control their body temperatures. So when we've had these series of severe cold fronts that have come through Texas this year, it rapidly dropped the water temperature, and these turtles that were in our bay waters came into this immobilized condition due to the cold weather. And if they weren't rescued, they most of the time would perish on the shoreline due to exposure to the elements or due to predation.
Like seagulls pecking away at them or something.
Well, seagulls could do it, but also vultures and coyotes as well actually consuming them while they're still alive on the beach. It's just a horrible thing to think about. And so we really try to get out there and rescue the turtles and bring them into rehab.
So did you send out a call? Did you use social media? Everyone come out here, try and find a turtle?
Well, this event was statewide, but concentrated most in South Texas, and in particular the Upper Laguna Madre. So it was a combination of many entities that were searching in the state, agencies and NGOs, as well as putting the word out to the public, too. If you were fishing or duck hunting or just walking along our bay shorelines or boating, please keep your eyes peeled and report these turtles to us so that we can rescue them.
So if you see a stunned turtle, then you would just call in? Don't try to, you know, put a towel around it or something?
Well, they're threatened and endangered animals, so we can't instruct the public to go out and, you know, pick them all up and bring them to us. But when the public did that, as Good Samaritans, we certainly took the animals and brought them into rehab. But most of the time what we get are actual reports of, oh, there's a turtle here or there's a turtle there, and not put a towel on it or anything like that, but just to report it to us as quickly as possible. Once we get these turtles in hand, we gradually warm them up. We don't want to warm them up too quickly.
So how big are these turtles? What do they look like?
They range anywhere from about 12 inches across all the way to 2.5 to nearly 3 feet in length. So there's a variety of sizes. They're brown in color on the top, and then on the underside, they're a creamy white color.
So that's the green sea turtle.
It was once much more numerous than it is now. It was actually so numerous that in the late 1800s, it was actually commercially harvested. But unfortunately, between over-harvesting and severe freezes, it caused the population to plummet and become very depleted by the year 1900.
Now, the Kemp's Ridley sea turtle, we're coming up on nesting season, right?
Yes, this is quite a challenging time for us because we're having to rapidly move from cold stunning right into getting ready for the nesting season. Kemp's Ridley is the most critically endangered sea turtle, and they could begin nesting in early April. So we are working hard to train personnel, various areas of the state, people that will be patrolling, looking for nesting turtles and the tracks they leave in the sand, as well as we are providing training to other people that work on the beach during the nesting season.
This is not a static situation.
Sea turtles are threatened or endangered species. It takes a lot of organizations working together to try to protect them because they have a life phase that is reproduction on the nesting beaches, laying their eggs there, and then the majority of their lives spent at sea. They're far-ranging animals. So it's very complex. Different threats can develop in different areas.
Donna Shaver is chief of the Division of Sea Turtle Science and Recovery at Padre Island National Seashore with the U.S. National Park Service. She reminds us that the endangered sea turtles on the Texas coast are having a tough time these days. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org, and you can write on our show page on our website at tpr.org. That's also where you can listen to past Texas Matters programs, and you can find us online on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.